This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Thank you, Jack, and thank you, Institute for Governmental Studies. It's a pleasure to be partnering with them in presenting the Concord Coalition Fiscal Wake-Up Tour. I want to say a personal word of thanks to the Concord Coalition for all they've done for our country, and in the specific, for bringing this fiscal tour to our campus. The fiscal tour participants will be introduced in sequence as each of them speaks, and following their presentations, each of which will be 8 minutes, we'll then get into a dialogue and question and answer. So our first speaker is Bob Bixby, who is the executive director of the Concord Coalition. He has held that position since 1999. Prior to that, he was the program director for the Concord Coalition. Concord Coalition was established in 1992 by the late Senator Tsongas and Senator Warren Rudman. And after Senator Tsongas' passing, Senator Bob Kerry, former senator from Nebraska, became the co-chair. So it's always been bipartisan from its very inception, focused on the fiscal responsibility issues you'll hear about tonight. Executive Director Bixby holds his bachelor's degree from the American University, his law degree from George Mason University, and a master in public administration from the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. Robert Bixby.
Thank you very much, Dean Campbell. And I should say everybody's been saying nice things, thanking the Concord Coalition. But we do take the lead on the logistics, but our partners in this are the Heritage Foundation, the Brookings Institution, and Dave Walker from the Government Accountability Office. And so it's a joint effort of several organizations coming together on the Fiscal Wake-Up Tour. And we have indeed been going around the country following, we've been to places like New Hampshire and Iowa and South Carolina and Florida. If you're seeing a pattern here, you might understand that we're sort of looking at some of the key presidential states, and this year we'll be going to some of the battleground states. It's not as if any of us is going to run for anything. People understand that after they hear what we've had to say. It's a slightly different message than they're used to hearing it. But we know that the next president is going to have to make some crucial decisions. And so it's important for voters, whether they favor Republicans or favor Democrats or independents, whatever, to know that candidates appreciate the magnitude of the fiscal challenges facing our nation, appreciate the need to make some trade-offs in finding solutions, and the importance of acting sooner rather than later. Now, when the next president takes office, they're going to do so with a budget deficit of about $400 billion. That means that the government will be spending about $400 billion more than it's taking in. That is a challenge, but in fact, it is not the really big challenge. It's actually more the tip of the iceberg. Deficits of this size often in the past have been caused by factors that are at play now, such as a slowing economy and war. There's a big difference this time, and the big difference is the really big challenge that we're here to talk about and have been on the Fiscal Wake-Up Tour. The difference is that the nation is entering an unprecedented demographic transformation to an older society. And we're doing that against the backdrop of rising healthcare costs and very low national savings. And the combination of all of those is a very lethal one for the future health of the economy. Consider three factors. Right now, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, the three biggest federal entitlement programs, comprise 42% of the federal budget. That's quite a bit. And if you keep in mind that the baby boomers haven't really begun to retire yet, just now beginning to qualify for early retirement under Social Security. Now, you add in the demographic factors, and you can see that that will put a lot more pressure on these three programs. The percentage of the population age 65 and over is going to go from about 12% today to about 20% over the next 25 years. But demographics alone aren't the only problem. On top of that are rising healthcare costs. Healthcare costs have been rising faster than the economy for the past 40 years by a rate of about 2.5% a year. And if the same growth happens over the next 40 years, that is, healthcare costs rising relative to the size of the economy, if the same growth rates were to persist for the next 40 years as we've had for the past 40 years, you would find that just two programs, Medicare and Medicaid, would take up as much of the federal budget as much of our nation's economy as the entire federal budget does today. Now, other speakers will talk about some of the implications of that for the future. I'd like to drop back now just to the present and show you a freeze frame of last year's federal budget and where it came out. And this is where we ended up on a cash basis with a deficit of $163 billion. But the thing I would like you to note is that top line on the spending side, that is the net interest. The government spent about $238 billion on interest. Now, when the government runs debts, it has to pay interest when it borrows money, just like anybody else. And $238 billion is almost 10% of the federal budget. It's quite a bit of spending. It's more than the government spent on, say, the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's more than the federal government's share of the Medicaid program. So if you occasionally hear people say that deficits don't matter, this is if they didn't matter, we wouldn't be paying $238 billion, or about 10% of the budget. Now, changing course. Before we change course, let's talk about where things stand as a percentage of the economy. Very often, people will talk about these issues as a percentage of GDP, as a percentage of the economy. It's a more relevant way of looking at these things than dollar figures alone. And if you look at this, you see that more or less by coincidence, we're not too far off our historic rates at the present time. Generally speaking, the government over the past 25, 30 years or so has tended to spend at about 20-21% of GDP, and revenues are a little bit above 18% of GDP. So we run these deficits around 2%. Now, if that were the pattern going out into the future, we might be concerned and would like to see lower budget deficits, but we probably wouldn't be running around doing a fiscal wake-up tour. Keep these numbers in mind as you hear what the other speakers say about where spending may be headed as a percentage of the economy. Now, changing course is going to require some fundamental decisions, and the American people need to be involved in those decisions, and that's where the fiscal wake-up tour comes in. This guy on the horse here is Paul Revere. And the reason that we show Paul Revere is not just because that this is the Concord Coalition, so we have to talk about Paul Revere, but he symbolizes what we're doing here. This is not about gloom and doom. It's a warning. And we think that the American people and their leaders can change course if they are adequately informed. Members of the Fiscal Wake-Up Tour do not agree on the right level of spending, taxes, and debt. But we do agree on the following points. We all agree that current policy is unsustainable, that there are no quick and easy solutions that people like to talk about, like cutting waste, fraud, and abuse, or just simply trying to grow our way out of it. We all agree that there are going to need to be bipartisan solutions. Both sides need to be willing to look at all options. Public engagement is very important to this. That's why we're out here doing this. And finally, and most importantly to us, this is really a moral issue. It's not just about numbers. It's about the legacy that we leave to future generations. Tom, are you going to introduce the next speaker, or do you want me to do it?
Sure.
I will, in introducing the next speaker, just let you know that he has been, from time to time, referred to as the rock star of the fiscal wake-up tour. And it's not often that a government accountant or a CPA of any sort is referred to as a rock star. So that's something to aspire to. He is the Comptroller General of the United States, the rock star of the fiscal wake-up tour, David Walker.
Since we're meeting here in the Arthur Anderson Auditorium, that I was a partner with Arthur Anderson and Global Managing Director for 9.5 years before they had their problems. I had nothing to do with Enron, WorldCom, you know, waste management. You fill in the blank, but in any event. And also, in the interest of full and fair disclosure, 1 week from today will be my last day at GAO because I'm going to become the CEO of a new foundation, the Peter G. Peterson Foundation, which will be focused on this and other sustainability challenges because Washington is broken badly, and there need to be a lot more aggressive efforts in order to try to be able to help make sure that elected officials make tough choices sooner rather than later. And frankly, I've gone about as far as I can as Comptroller General, and you need to go further. So we're going to bring more flexibility and financial resources to the target to hope that we can end up getting some results sooner rather than later. But with that, let me talk to you a little bit about where the budget has been, where we are, and where we're headed. And it's the last part that's the problem. It's not today. It's not the past. It's where we're headed. We're headed into very rough seas that could swamp the ship of state if we don't get serious soon. In 1967, 45% of the federal budget was for defense and 2% was for Medicare and Medicaid. In 2007, 21% was for Medicare and Medicaid and 20% for national defense. In 1967, when the Congress came to Washington, they got to decide how two-thirds of the federal budget would be spent. In 2007, it was down to 38%. Stated differently, 62% of the federal budget was on autopilot, and a significant portion of that 62% is represented by blank check. The United States is the only country on the face of the earth that writes a blank check for health care cost. No one can afford to write a blank check for health care cost, including the United States, because if there's one thing that could bankrupt America, it's runaway health care costs. Now, interestingly, those of you that are connoisseurs of the Constitution, as I am, will find that if you go back and look at the express and enumerated responsibilities the founding fathers ascribed to the federal government at the beginning of our republic, all of those are in the 38% of the budget that's getting squeezed. National defense, homeland security, federal judicial system, treasury, foreign policy, postal, Congress of the United States, executive office of the president, and yet they're getting squeezed. The federal government has three deficit numbers. I wouldn't say it has three sets of books, but it definitely has three deficit numbers. And guess which ones elected officials like to talk about? The least bad numbers, the middle set of numbers. But when you look at the fact that the federal government spends every dime of the Social Security surplus on other government operating expenses, the real cash-based budget deficit is marked in red. And guess what? That $163 billion number for 07 is going to be $410 in 08. And you can add to that 410 about another $180 billion that will be spent in the form of the Social Security surplus being spent on something else. The United States has become addicted to debt. We're running deficits in good times and bad, adding to our debt burdens, and unfortunately, too many American families are following the bad example of their federal government. They're spending more than they make and increasing their debt burdens. Bottom line on this graphic, it may be a little bit difficult to follow, is while the three deficit numbers have gone down for 3 years in a row. The accumulated liabilities and unfunded commitments for Social Security and Medicare are going up every year. And as I just mentioned, the deficit is set to escalate dramatically this year. Here's the real problem. Forget about deficits. Forget about current debt. That's not the real problem. The real problem is this graphic. In the last 7 years alone, the total liabilities and unfunded commitments for Social Security and Medicare, the difference between what has been promised and the amount of dedicated payroll taxes and premiums to deliver on those promises, the gap in current dollar terms has grown from $20 trillion, there's 12 zeros to the right of that 20, to $53 trillion in 7 years. From 20 to 53 in 7 years. And the Medicare prescription drug benefit alone is $8.4 trillion, and Medicare is $34 trillion of the $53 trillion. Now, how do you translate $53 trillion into something that we might be able to relate to? It's 90% of the estimated net worth of every American. It's $175,000 per person, including each newborn. It's $440,000 per household. And median household income in America is less than $50,000 a year, believe it or not. And by the way, that $53 trillion number is going up $2 to $3 trillion a year by doing nothing. That's the cost of waiting. 7 years ago, this is what our fiscal future looked like. The line represents revenues as a percentage of the economy. The bar represents spending. You can see that we had short-term surpluses and fiscal sustainability for 40-plus years. We actually thought we were going to pay off all the national debt in January of 2001. That's why you don't see any blue line at the bottom of the bar, because it was all paid off. We don't have to worry about that anymore. This is where we stand today, based upon reasonable assumptions. Reasonable assumptions are no Social Security and Medicare reform, which we can't allow to happen, but if you assume that we tax at historical levels of about 18.5% of the economy, which is where we are now, and we just debt finance the difference, and that the rest of government grows by the rate of the economy. This is not just a federal problem. It's a state-local problem. Bottom line of this graphic, state and local governments face large and growing deficits within the next 10 years due primarily to four reasons. Medicaid cost, unfunded retiree health care, underfunded pension plans, and deferred maintenance and other critical infrastructure needs. So the bottom line is the status quo is not an option. There's no way we're going to grow our way out of this problem. Anybody who tells you we can do that, one, hasn't studied economic history, and number two, probably wouldn't pass math. So we need to be honest about where we are and where we're headed. We need to reimpose tough budget controls like the ones expired in 2002. We need to reform our legislative processes to consider the longer-term cost and affordability of tax and spending proposals. And we're going to need to transform our entitlement programs, the base of spending, and tax policy. It's a heavy lift, but we're going to have to do it all in installments over the next few years. Believe it or not, this great nation, possibly the greatest in the history of mankind, on a set of key outcome-based indicators, is ranked 16 out of number 30 for major industrialized nations. I can tell you that as a certified public accountant, that is officially below average. We can, we must, and I believe if we get serious, we will do better. The sooner we get started, the easier it'll be. Public education engagement is critical, but keep in mind, this is not just about numbers. It's about values. And I'll give you a word, stewardship. And I'll also let you know that it's not just about values, it's about people. And here's who it's about for me. These are my three grandchildren. I got married at 19. I've been married to the same woman for 36 years. These are our grandchildren. They didn't cause this problem. It's their problem. They're going to pay the price. They're going to bear the burden. if tough choices aren't made, and they're obviously too young to vote. They don't have a voice. Their granddaddy is their voice. Thank you.
Alice Rivlin is our next speaker. She has just about every major position in fiscal responsibility in federal government. She was the founding director of the Congressional Budget Office. She was the vice chair of the Federal Reserve. She was the director of the Office of Management and Budget. She was an assistant secretary in the administration of President...
Oh, you don't have to talk
all right,
about that.
By simply, simply too many credentials, received her master's and PhD from Radcliffe College of Harvard University and her undergraduate degree from Bryn Mawr.
Right.
Alice Rivlin.
Thank you, Don. I'm going to be very retro. I'm not going to use slides. I'm here with my colleagues from across the political spectrum because I share with them a strong conviction that Americans are not facing up to a really big problem that we've created for ourselves. We've made more commitments to spend federal money than we can afford to keep. These commitments or promises are built into the three big programs, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. We need to re-examine those commitments to look at the resources that we will have available over the coming years, the other claims on them, and decide what to do. Doing nothing is not an option. Now, this problem is not insoluble. Sometimes when we talk in trillions and all of these big numbers, it sounds like, oh, we could never do anything about that. There are many solutions, but it won't solve itself, and the longer we wait, the more painful the choices are going to be. Now, these are good kinds of problems to have. They grew out of good intentions to protect seniors and the disabled and low-income people from loss of income and from the rising cost of medical care. And it's a good thing to have people living longer, and health care is more effective, and that's good too. It's also more expensive. But these successes and good intentions create serious problems for the federal budget. The Comptroller General is an accountant, and he likes to think in present value terms of unfunded liabilities, and that gets you into an awful lot of trillions. I'm an economist, and I like to think about how much programs are costing as a percent of everything we produce, our GDP. Now, Social Security costs about 4% of our GDP right now. Over the next few years, it'll rise to 6%. That's the demographic effect of keeping the promises that we've already made. That's half again as much as we're spending now, but it doesn't sound impossible. It's the growth of Medicare and Medicaid, which is more dramatic because these programs are on track to claim a continuously rising share of the GDP. They compound the two factors, the aging of the population and the rising health care spending per person. As Bob Bixby said, health care spending for all of us has been going up about 2.5 percentage points faster than the GDP for 40 years. It doesn't take very much sophistication to realize that that's a problem, and it affects all of us. If these trends continue, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid will get to the 18 or 20% of the whole economy that we are now spending on the whole federal government by the end of the 1930s, of the 2030s. Now, maybe we can find a way to reduce the rapid growth of healthcare spending. We certainly should try. Maybe we can reduce it to 2% faster than the GDP, or 1.5%, or even if we're lucky, 1%. But new drugs and new treatments are coming online all the time, and we're going to want them, and we're going to use them, and they're going to be more expensive. So I think we're kidding ourselves if we think that healthcare spending is going to drop to the rate of the GDP. And if that's true, then Medicare and Medicaid, or their successor programs, will continue to grow faster than all of our spending, and that federal revenues grow at any reasonable set of tax rates. So the result is very tough choices. What do? We raise taxes continuously. We keep cutting other spending until it's all gone. We push costs onto the state or into the private sector. Probably some combination of all of those things. The option we've been relying on recently is don't think about it, just borrow more money. We've been spending more than we've been taking in taxes and passing the IOUs on to future taxpayers, those terribly attractive grandchildren of the Comptroller General. I've got some, too. But in the face of the rapidly rising commitments under Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, that option, just borrow more money, is not either economically or morally viable. It's economically dangerous. Rising deficits reduce economic growth through their effect on pushing up interest rates. They make us much more vulnerable to our creditors, and our creditors are mostly now foreign governments. And the task of, the toll of the downside of keeping on borrowing more money is beginning to become apparent in the falling dollar. We've seen it already, and it could get much worse. The economics of continuous borrowing are not attractive, but it's also immoral. It's not fair to our children and our grandchildren to pass the burden on to them or to leave them with a damaged economy. So why are we acting in this immoral and short-sighted way? It's a little hard to figure. We're somehow in psychological denial. We cling to a whole bunch of convenient myths that we can grow our way out of the deficits. No, we can't. We'd have to grow at double-digit rates forever to catch up with this rate of spending. That we can cut taxes and that'll stimulate the economy and then we'll grow faster and taxes will pay for themselves. No, they won't. Tax cuts are stimulative of the economy, but no serious economist believes that you can go on cutting taxes without cutting spending and not create serious problems for the economy. Or the opposite. Oh, well, we'll just raise taxes. They're not as high as the Europeans, and we'll solve our problem that way. No, we won't, because we'd have to raise them continuously to solve this problem. Or we'll just cut waste. That's a good idea. And making the healthcare system more efficient is a good idea. But it's not going to solve the problem. All of these myths are partial truths. They're good things to do, but not solutions. We need to stop telling ourselves stories and admit that we have a problem. Make decisions about how much we want to spend on what and how to pay for it. Those are conversations that we are not now having, either in the context of the political campaign or very much of anywhere. And that's what the Fiscal Wake Up Tour is trying to bring to your attention. Thank you.
Costa Fraser is our last speaker. She is the director of the Institute for Economic Studies at the Heritage Foundation, a position that she's held since 2003. Prior to that, she held the job that I did in California. She held it in Oklahoma. She was the finance director for the state and helped Governor Keating with his fiscal and economic policies. And prior to that, she was a fiscal manager for Orange County after it got into trouble. So the same sort of caveat that we heard about Arthur Andersen applies to Ms. Fraser, and help them work out their budgetary problems following their near bankruptcy. Ms. Fraser.
Thank you very much. I'm going to build on my colleagues' presentations and illustrate the challenges that we face, as well as some of the choices. And I'm going to start with a brief review of what you've already heard. Okay, let's get the thing to work here. And let's look historically at where we are in terms of the budgetary context. Taxes, remember, you heard, are about 18% of the economy, and that's really the post-World War II average, while spending has averaged about 20% of the economy. And if you notice the blue, that represents Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. And you can see how over the past, since 1975 in this chart, they have really grown tremendously. And in my mind, one of the key reasons for that is that entitlements really function on budget autopilot. Now, most programs, those that Dave especially talked about, all the other priorities, including those things enumerated in the Constitution, most of those programs, Congress sets annual budgets that are constrained, and they have serious debates about our budgetary priorities. However, there are no annual budgets for entitlements. Instead, they grow in concert with the formulas that are established in their authorizing laws. So what this sets up in the future is a giant tsunami of spending. So we would see, within two generations, the federal budget going from 20% of the economy to 50% of the economy. And this obviously is a real problem. And what would happen, as you heard my colleagues say, is that these entitlements would in fact begin to crowd out other priorities that we hold very valuable as a nation. Now, on this path, what would happen if interest rates increased, as we have ever larger deficits and debt? Well, you see here, with a very modest interest rate increase, the fiscal meltdown happens even sooner. And what I want you to think about is, because of this budgetary autopilot nature of entitlements, this is the course that we are on today, and all of the legislative dynamics, all of the budget dynamics, support and enforce this path. So let's talk for a moment about taxes, because no conversation about fiscal and budget policy is really complete without a discussion of taxes. And let's think about, first of all, where are they going in the future? And the red line right here shows you where we are today in comparison with the historical average, and we're actually right about that today. And according to current law, however, taxes are set to go up. And in fact, they are set to surpass the highest levels of taxation this nation has ever seen in 11 years. Why is that? That's due to the huge increase in the alternative minimum tax and because the tax cuts are set to expire. But even if taxes are allowed to rise to this level, it will not solve this fiscal challenge that we face. Now, if the tax cuts are extended, you see that there's a little budgetary difference, but not a large one. And moreover, taxes will be increasing over the levels that we have today. And I'd like just to illustrate the magnitude of this problem to you. If the challenge was solved solely through taxes, you would see a tax burden growing from this 18% level today to 30% of the economy. That is a startling level. And not only that, taxes would need to keep on going up in the future as the costs of these programs continue to expand. So now you're probably thinking, I don't really know what 30% of the economy means to me and means to my family. So let's think about it in terms of income tax rates. What we would see is today's income tax rates needing to grow by 2.5 times, such that the lowest income tax rate today is 10%, it would need to grow to 26%. The highest rate would go from 35% to 92%. And this is only federal income taxes. You'd have to add on state income taxes, which in California are very high. You'd have to add on payroll taxes of about 7.5%. This is the level of taxation that we have locked in order to pay for these programs. Now, nobody's proposing this, but I really want you to think about what this magnitude is. And I want to say, I don't have any grandkids yet, but I do have 3 teenagers, and this is the burden that they will have to pay. But in spite of all the angst that they give me as teenagers, in spite of all the high blood pressure that they give me, you know, I really want a different future for them. I think that we can do better. So I'm going to turn to the other part of the budget, and that's the spending part. So what would happen, you know, if we continue on this current path, as Alice talked about, and just left these entitlements alone and try to do things solely on the spending side of the ledger, it's very, very difficult. Watch as I start to eliminate some programs, and watch very, very closely. I'm going to eliminate across, sort of across priorities. I'm going to start with the National Endowment for the Arts. Watch the line closely. You didn't see it go down, and I eliminated an entire program. So now we'll eliminate NASA. Went down a little bit, foreign aid, all earmark spending. And in fact, I have eliminated dozens of programs and literally tens of thousands of projects and not made very much progress towards this budget impasse. In fact, you could eliminate the entire Department of Defense tomorrow and you wouldn't solve the problem over the long term. So this is to illustrate to you, we really must change the direction of entitlements. So let me lay out briefly my path, and there's, you've heard a number of other ideas, my sort of suggestions for solving this problem. I really think that the key is changing the legislative dynamics and the legislative incentives for action. That would mean taking these programs off of this budgetary autopilot that they're on. I would put them on a long-term constrained budget. And one of the benefits of this is that it would level the playing field among all budgetary priorities and require tough and conscious trade-offs. We don't have those today, and that's why you see those programs growing so fast, and especially in the future. Another thing that I would do is to include a measure of the long-term entitlement obligations at $53 trillion that Dave talked about in the annual budget. And if Congress really wanted to increase that $175,000 burden on Dave's grandkids, they should have to take a tough vote in order to do that. Another thing that I would do is to make retirement programs fair but affordable. And if I've conveyed nothing else today, it is that the social insurance model for entitlement programs that we have today is not sustainable. So I think there's a number of things that we can do. This would really involve two steps in my view. The first one is to target resources to those who need them the most, and there's a number of ways that we can do that. The second is that I think we all need to assume greater personal responsibility in terms of saving for our retirement future, and those are our foreseeable retirement needs. I do think that taxes have a role in this. And in my view, taxes should be simple, they should be flat, growth-oriented, and internationally competitive. So in closing, this is a very tough challenge that we face, but there are real solutions, and we look forward to taking your questions on those right now.
I'm going to engage in a discussion with the panel while we collect your questions. So if you would please pass them to the aisle now, they'll be sorted and brought to my attention. But let me start out the questioning with directing it to Bob Bixby, though other members of the panel may wish to participate. In the year 2000, we balanced. In the year 2000, we had a surplus in the federal budget of $86 billion. Now, we've been in deficit ever since, and in deficit the years prior to that, way back to 1974. But we did actually do it in the year 2000. So my question to Bob would be, what did we do right then that is so difficult to replicate now?
Well, I think that there was an accumulation of things. You know, you go back to, say, 1992, when we had, Ross Perot was running and Paul Tsongas was running. The deficit was very high, and the public seemed to be concerned about lowering the deficit. And President Clinton, to his credit, with Alice's help, pushed through a deficit reduction plan. And throughout the 90s, the deficit began to come down. He worked with a Republican Congress, and there was spending restraint, there were budget controls, they avoided tax cuts or that weren't matched by spending cuts, they avoided big entitlement expansions. We did have a strong economy. We also had a peace dividend from the end of the Cold War. There were a lot of factors that came together and worked over a number of years to produce this surplus. So I think the lesson from that is that budget deficits don't just go away on their own. When politicians and the public get together and put some effort behind it on a bipartisan basis, fiscal responsibility can work. So it's not a pipe dream. It is. You can look back over that period and say it actually did happen.
I'll turn to Alice, and may I, in turning to you, ask if Graham Rudman-Hollings had any good effect in that?
I don't think Graham Rudman-Hollings was a well-intentioned piece of legislation, but it was not effective. The effective thing were the rules that were put in place in 1990 by President Bush, 41, and the Democratic Congress, who, sensing a real crisis, came together bipartisan and put in place the budget rules that the Clinton administration benefited from, because they were in effect until 2002. They were the caps on discretionary spending. Everything had to get under the cap. And the so-called PAYGO rules, which meant you couldn't pass, you couldn't even propose a tax cut or an entitlement spending increase unless you had offsets of equal amount over the budget period. It wasn't that the Clinton administration never thought of prescription drugs for Medicare or a middle-class tax cut. In fact, the president had campaigned on it, but we couldn't pay for it. And the rules really worked.
Yeah. I want to, before I turn to David, just to ask Allison on this, because I might get a different point of view, and if I don't, that's fine, too. Alice Rivlin identifies the unwillingness to cut taxes as a component in a successful budgetary deficit constraint. Yet good friends of mine on the Laffer curve side of the argument suggest that if we don't occasionally or have targeted tax cuts, we might choke off growth, and growth is a generator of more revenue. Do you want to give us your point? Well, would you kindly give us your point of view on that?
Well, there were a whole lot of questions there that I could tackle. I mean, I think that our tax policy is extremely important. And, you know, that's kind of why I did take some of my presentation time to talk about taxes. Certainly, there are elements of the Laffer curve, I think, that are very important that show that there's sort of an optimum level of taxation and revenue maximization. I think that sort of in my view, some of the tax cuts that we had in 01 and 03, there were different kinds. Some were growth-oriented tax cuts, and some were really more sort of, I'll call them socially oriented tax cuts. The ones that were growth-oriented I thought were really very effective, and they had much less of a revenue impact. You know, some people feel that they paid for themselves, and there's a lot of very, you know, rigorous debate about that. I think the important thing is that not all tax cuts are created equally, and I don't think that you can cut taxes forever and not have it have a real impact. That being said, I think that, you know, it is important that we seek to keep the burden of taxes on our economy low. And as I showed in one of my charts, taxes are going up. Under current law, they are going to go up for three basic reasons: the alternative minimum tax, the expiration of the tax cuts, and for real growth. So, you know, this sort of normal level of taxation that we've had of about 18% of our economy has, to me, sort of indicated that there's a threshold that Americans and the economy are sort of willing to take.
Before turning to David for his comment, I do want to share one quick comment. When I was in Congress, I had a colleague who honestly said this and then realized what he'd said, that because he totally believed in the Laffer curve, that if only we could get the federal tax rate down to zero, we'd really get federal revenue. I'm glad you got it. he didn't. David.
Well, what I was going to mention is that the budget controls that were in place in the 1990s were a major contributor to help us move from deficits to surpluses, and they expired in 2002. And Washington has been out of touch and out of control for a number of years, and that was one of the reasons why, because there are no controls in place anymore. You know, some people say during the Johnson administration there was the guns and butter policy. Recently, we've had guns and butter and tax cuts. And sooner or later, people need to understand the math has got to work. I mean, the math isn't close to working now, and time is going to make it even more difficult. As Allison said, all tax cuts are not created equally. Some stimulate the economy, some don't. But even the ones that stimulate the economy, they rarely pay for themselves. They may recapture part of the lost revenue through additional economic growth, but they rarely pay for themselves. And, you know, we need to recognize that reality as well.
I frequently hear that a capital gains tax reduction does pay for itself based on the record of the Kennedy administration and the Reagan administration. Do you think that's right or wrong, David?
Well, first, the ones that I've seen, I'm not a PhD economist. I'm well-read, but I'm not a PhD economist. And the two that I've heard that typically have the most positive impact and have the potential to pay for themselves are dramatic reductions in marginal tax rates, which we had during the Kennedy administration, and significant reductions in tariffs. Now, obviously, reductions in the capital gains rates, you know, you're dealing with investments, and that you can end up recapturing part of the cost more. Don't know that they'll pay for themselves, but they clearly have more of a stimulative effect. And then you have to ask yourself, how much of that is a timing difference? Because people are accelerating transactions, you know, taxation of transactions, because they may not think it's going to stay that way, versus a longer-term impact.
You may want. No, I agree with that. But we have brought the marginal tax rates down so far over time through the Reagan administration, and you know, some of us who are old enough can remember when the marginal top tax rate was 70%, and we're nowhere near that now.
Well, I remember that too. I was pursuing my economic studies at the time. So I have a question from the audience, which is absolutely apt at this very moment. So it begins, which members of the panel are willing to publicly support a tax increase in order to balance the federal and or California state budget? So the non-Californians can certainly speak to increasing taxes in California. but I'll ask the panel, it's a fair question, and if the answer is no, that's fine. But is there any member who's willing to support a tax increase as part of the solution?
Sure. I mean, I'll go first. To me, the trick here is to try to achieve a sustainable path with spending, taxes, and debt all at levels that are conducive to long-term economic growth. You can't think of taxes and spending as two separate issues. So to the extent that you're not going to make spending reductions, and as we all emphasize, the spending reductions we need to worry about are not the things that you usually hear about, the waste, fraud, and abuse, and the pork barrel spending, earmarks, that sort of thing. It's the two federal health care entitlements and Social Security that are driving the long-term growth. So to the extent that we do not reduce spending on that, we're going to have to raise revenues to pay for it. So I think it's going to take a combination of both, probably.
Very well. David, you're next.
Of the $53 trillion hole that we're in, I think we're going to have to get the most money out of reforming entitlement programs. I think we're also going to have to get some money out of constraining and reprioritizing spending. And I also think that we're going to have more revenues than 18.5% of GDP, which is what we have right now. But that should be achieved through comprehensive tax reform, because I think our current system right now is very inefficient, very ineffective, not very credible. One must keep in mind, based upon the graphic that Allison showed, that under current law, if you do nothing, taxes will rise to about 24% of GDP. We can solve the problem at less than 24% of GDP, at materially less than 24% of GDP, if we act sooner rather than later. On the other hand, if we don't act, then Allison's chart also showed that if you tried to solve the problem through taxes alone, which would be fundamentally imprudent, you go to levels far in excess of that. Americans historically have not allowed themselves to be taxed more than about 20.5% of GDP. That's where we were in 2001. That's one of the reasons that we had a surplus. You may have a little tolerance to go somewhat more than that, but I don't think a whole lot more and for a variety of reasons.
I think David's right that you could balance the long-term budget at almost any level. But the point is, you've got to pay for what you want to do. And the spirit of the fiscal wake-up tour is not everybody says what their favorite solution is. It's that we all agree that there's a big problem and that we have to look at the both sides of the budget together and come out somewhere.
It's well said, and I don't mean to put anybody on the spot, but the question did seem to me fair. Let's talk about a few specifics. Mm. And there's one other I'd like to get to, but Allison, if you wanted to speak on this issue.
What I would say about California is exactly true as well for this larger problem for entitlements. And as a Californian, or former Californian, I guess, but still a Californian at heart, you know, California already has very high tax rates. And one of the things that, you know, all Californians, whether they live there or not now, need to remember is that, you know, you live in a competitive nation. And you don't want to squeeze your businesses out because that's the source of jobs, it's the source of income, and it's the source of growth. If you raise taxes, there will be some sort of cost on your competitiveness nationally. That very same issue holds true for us nationally as we think about entitlements. If we raise taxes to very high levels, we need to consider our global competitiveness position. And I would say specifically with regard to the corporate income tax, you know, many view big business as, you know, sort of the villain here in society today. But if you think about the corporate income tax, many of our jobs come from big business. The corporate income tax in America is among the highest in the industrialized world already. And if you want to increase taxes on big business, you will be driving away jobs. And that same sort of paradigm holds true for the state of California.
In fact, I might say even more so because the alternatives to locate are right next door. Arizona, Oregon, New Mexico and Texas
That's right.
are bidding for our business. Maybe a little bit more difficult to say we can set up exactly the comparable kind of industrial structure in Mexico, but certainly we could in Arizona. The specific questions that come, ask one or two others, and so let me just briefly put to the panel, among the others are postponing the retirement age at which your Social Security and Medicare benefits would vest in light of the greater life expectancy from now as opposed to the time when those laws were passed, and or means testing Medicare. And if anybody wishes to make a comment on those possible other specific solutions, I'd welcome it. Yes, David.
I think one of the elements of Social Security reform should include a further increase in not just the normal retirement age and indexing it to life expectancy gradually over time, but also the early retirement age. Because about 70% of people end up taking Social Security at the early retirement age. And the simple fact of the matter is, because of slower workforce growth, because the change in the nature of our economy, because of advancements in medical technology and a variety of other factors, we need to encourage people to work longer. That's what federal policy needs to do. Now, if people can afford to retire earlier, fine, but federal policy needs to encourage people to work longer. Last, on Medicare and health care in general, I think there's no question that federal policy needs to better target taxpayer subsidies for health care and better target tax preferences for health care than we do today.
I think that both of those ideas are ones that the Concord Coalition has supported in the past. There are proposals, for example, the Medicare drug benefit could be means tested. It's not right now. That's one of the proposals. Medicare Part B, which is another part of Medicare, does have a modest means test, simply meaning it's a reduction in the subsidy. I mean, Medicare is Part B and D, the drug program, is 75% financed out of general revenues. And so everybody's getting a subsidy in the size of their premium. So the idea there is it's really not so much means testing as most people understand that, but as a matter of income relating the premium so that upper income people get a less generous subsidy from the other taxpayers. And I think that that's a good idea, but you have to be realistic about the savings you get from something like that. You really don't get huge savings from that. When the Concord Coalition did a means testing proposal back in the mid-90s for all federal entitlement programs, we found that in order to get really big savings, you had to start the means test at about the median income. And a lot of people at that level of income did not consider themselves sufficiently affluent that they should be means tested for anything. So you really do need to I think those are good ideas, and I think they should definitely be done, particularly changing the longevity, as Dave mentioned, for Social Security and even for Medicare. But on the means testing thing, we should do it, but you're not going to get huge savings out of it.
There are a number of questions on the international implications, so let me turn to that. They go into a couple of different directions, but if I put them out at the same time, perhaps you'd respond to what you were most comfortable responding to. The first would be, are there any lessons that we could learn from other countries which have the same kind of demographic shift or even more so? I might remark in this connection that I was in Japan last week, and of course they have a very big demographic shift towards the older side, and that their budget deficit is running at a ratio of 168% their debt, their total debt, is 168% of their annual GDP. Our total debt is a 67%, so substantially lower as a percentage of our GDP. And then the other direction the questions are running are, should we be concerned that so much of our public debt is held by foreign investors? And Alice referred to that briefly in her remarks, so it might be appropriate to turn to her first on that, but I happen to anticipate that question. And so let me just share with you what the numbers are. Japan is the largest creditor to the United States at $586 billion. China, I might say Greater China, which includes Taiwan, Singapore, Hong Kong, as well as mainland China, $400 billion. United Kingdom, $244 billion. And then the Gulf states at $123 billion. So those are the international directed questions.
I think we should be very concerned about the size of our growing debt, but also about the fact that so much of it is held by mostly foreign governments and foreign central banks. It just gives them a lot of leverage over us. And that's not a very good position to be in. Up to now, there's been a kind of codependency. They wanted to keep their currencies from appreciating against the dollar, and we wanted to borrow money, and so it all worked out. But eventually, many countries are going to feel they don't want to hold so many dollars. Some of them already think that. And we don't want to be as beholden to the rest of the world for continuing this paying for our profligacy, which is what it really is, as we are now.
I want to thank Bob Bixby, David Walker, Alice Rivlin, and Allison Acosta-Fraser for their time and for their sharing that time with the Berkeley community. Won't you join me in thanking them?
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.